Parsec, a whole new show exploring sci-fi and science fiction in all its manifestations.
What does the future sound like?
Coming on Sunday for Siren 107.3 FM.
What does the future sound like?
The future will be silent.
What does the future...
With your pilots Dave Milling and Alex Leftuk. And a positive galaxy of co-presentational stars.
The future will be silent.
Well, who'd have thought, eh?
No one would have believed in the last years of the 19th century that human affairs were being watched from the timeless worlds of space.
Or that Dave Milling would return to Parsec. Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever time we're going out on Parsec's podcast. How are you?
I'm a lot better, thank you. The wall of Stephen Moffat-related, time-related sickness loop.
So much to pack in, Dave. We've got yourself, we've got obviously a whole heap of other goodies.
Richard Burton.
Yeah, exactly. We've got, obviously, the man behind the War of the Worlds, Jeff Wayne. We've got Alan Stevens, and we've got Paul Terry. All this and more on Parsec. Certainly names who are legendary within the music business, and indeed in the science fiction world. And when you actually put together the names H.G. Wells and Jeff Wayne, you get true magic. And I speak as one who certainly was a continual fan of the original War of the Worlds album, and once indeed said, what a fantastic stage show this would make. Of course, it's manifested as a sensational stage show. It's currently undergoing, I can't believe it's the final arena tour, but we're delighted to be able to connect with the legendary, as mentioned, genuinely wonderful Jeff Wayne. Jeff, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for that super introduction.
It's a tremendous epoch-making album. I mean, I say that quite deliberately. Back in 1978, who would have believed that such a marvellous thing could have actually sort of emerged? The sonorous tones of obviously Richard Burton, right the way through to obviously Justin and his marvellous sort of Forever Autumn, etc. Justin Haywood, of course, a whole range of other factors. I mean, this is just something which resonates so much that musically, it's just a fantastic event.
Well, if you were asking me before it came out, would I be talking to you 36 or so years later with the history that the recordings and now the arena tours and other things that we've done would sort of grow from the original album? I would never have dreamed it would have had the life that it has had. I'm proud of it and thrilled to have worked with all the people that I have done along the way.
Of course, yes, I mean, Julie Covington, of course, David Essex. I mean, that's the original cast. But then, just when people thought, you can't possibly do it again, you jolly well went and did it again with virtually a completely new cast, and it's still, with Liam Neeson, etc., still actually has that magic.
Well, thanks for that. Yeah, it was a one of those decisions that came about a couple of years ago when I just finished a tour and went on holiday, in fact, with my family, and I listened to the original recording that I did with Richard, took with me the original script, because I hadn't revisited it in many years, and I just thought, you know, every so often I'm asked, would I ever consider re-recording it, looking at it with fresh eyes, and on this particular occasion, I thought, yeah, okay, it's a good time to revisit it, and what I discovered and remembered that, in fact, whatever wound up on the original album and the usage of Richard's voice and bringing him, so to speak, back to life and as a talking head for the first five or six tours we did, was that there was at least as much on the original album that, or the original recording that didn't make it onto the album, as there was that did. And I thought, gosh, there's a lot of rich material story-wise. And I think the largest reason that a lot of the original material didn't make it onto the double album was that it was the era of the black vinyl disc. And there were just so many minutes per side you could actually fit in that I had to make editing decisions, musical ones as well. But now, all these years later, I'm looking at it and listening to it again, and I thought, well, if I was to start all over again, I would include a lot of what the story could have been, and particularly for the live arena shows that we were doing, it was a natural to extend it. So in a way, that triggered off the new double album, because I was convinced there was a good reason for doing it. And I extended, therefore, the story. Richard, as a statistic, had 74 sequences, and Liam Neeson now has 90. And by opening up the story, it opened up opportunities on a musical level and all sorts of other things, so that the whole new recording is just that. It's brand new, new artists. And our last production and our next one incorporates everything that was on the new approach. It's still the War of the Worlds in its heart and soul, but it's also benefited from expanding it.
Listening to The Eve of the War, even now on vinyl and indeed the digital version, it has a resonance that kind of just sort of seems to grip the sort of the inner soul and just transport one into all sorts of wonderful ways. I'm sure that Herbert George Wells himself was around. He would have said, actually, yes, it does kind of capture that sense of end of the 19th century, the sort of sense of anticipation that we actually felt there, and also the fear that obviously alien invasion and indeed a superior civilization can actually have if it should come into contact with us puny humans, really.
Yeah, when you look at it, that H.G. Wells wrote it as a young man at the height of the British Empire and its expansionism, and the fact that in Victorian times, what would we have defended ourselves with but rifles, some cannons, and a few good warships, but against an alien being that was all brain, the size of a bear, and incredible machines and weaponry, that fear factor that you're talking about to me was always much more terrifying if I set it in the time and stay true to what H.G. Wells created. And I think that helped convince the listener that this sort of not a fair playing field existed, and it therefore made it scarier.
And suddenly the ooh-la sound, which, I mean, most people would obviously remember as synonymous with the whole thing. The late astronomer, of course, Sir Patrick Moore, who I spoke to, and I was fortunate enough to speak to on many occasions, was I know, quite a fan of the whole piece. So he obviously, there wasn't a place to fit in his xylophone playing into War of the Worlds, but maybe he'd still been around. We could have done something.
You never know.
Indeed. And indeed, one recalls a piece I did with Sue Mann Hennick from the dance troupe Legs & Co. when, even then, I thought it would have made a nice little line to do a sort of ballet version. It took a long time, of course, before you got into the notion of the stage show. But when that whole idea came up of actually going on stage, was it a case of you thought, well, this is going to be a brave attempt, or did you think, yes, let's run with it?
Well, it was sort of an evolution in that when the first time the album came out and was flying high in the charts, there were opportunities for me to take it on tour, but the offers were generally more of concert renditions. And I always saw that the vision, the H.G. Wells vision, and what I had hoped to extend through the musical version, was a big stage type of concept, something that, in fact, didn't exist in those early years, and the few spaces that did, and I'm excluding stadiums, the cost of bringing to an audience what was sort of in my mind, either technologically it didn't exist, or that which did exist was so limited and also so expensive that it really needed time to catch up with offering technology in a way that allowed us to do what we started doing in 2006. And interestingly, even now, looking back after 8.5 years of touring, every production has grown. Technology, even in this period of time, has changed substantially, which is why every production is essentially adding new ingredients, topping the previous production, and replacing what even now is our older technologies with brand new ones.
From the department of where you never can actually tell where genius will emerge from, I couldn't believe that the Forever Autumn part, the hook because you're not here, actually started off as a jingle for a Lego commercial.
That's right. It is one of those remarkable things of where something or the seed of something starts. It wasn't sung in the sense of with words. It was more like a Simon and Garfunkel, and when they used to go do-do-do-do, and that sort of vocal approach. But it was essentially the first verse of what then became a full-blown song called Forever Autumn. It started off because the public started writing in, what is that piece of music? Never realizing that it was resonating so much to the general public as it was, as you said, it was supporting a Lego toys commercial. But it did, and the two singers that were on it also became a vocal duo, and they wrote a whole album's worth of songs. They wrote the lyrics, I wrote the music and did the arrangements and the productions, and one of those songs on their debut album was Forever Autumn.
Indeed. Now, as we said at the start, Jeff, the final arena tour, I'm choking as I say that because I can't believe this can't be the end. It could only be the end of the beginning, perhaps. But clearly, throughout November, some fantastic, it's the Dublin O2 Arena on the 27th of November, the Liverpool Echo Arena on the 28th, the Glasgow based 29th, Manchester Phones for You Arena on the 30th, and of course, Nottingham on December the 2nd, the Capital FM Arena. And then, of course, December 3rd, you're up in Newcastle. So you're getting around Birmingham, of course, Leeds, Cardiff, Bournemouth, London, Brighton, and Amsterdam also appear on the list. Shane Ward, an interesting addition to the cast in many ways.
Shane and all the others, with the exception of Jason Donovan, are all new to this particular production. Mm. And with every live production that we've done, or even going back to the original album or the more recent recording, it's always about trying to find artists who are obviously highly talented that fit the roles, the material that they're being asked to consider. And then you have the process of trying to reach them, see if they're interested, and whether there's a way of making it happen. And I've been very fortunate on all these occasions to wind up with tremendous people that have been great fun to work with, and always, because they're pretty successful in their own careers, they add their own sort of approach and magic to each role, and Shane being one of them.
Well, certainly the voice of the artilleryman, or the artilleryman, the character, the line that was used, which certainly I found very evocative with the days of David Essex, where it's thinking and doing the working that's the really hard part. It's wonderful in that sense of word. Clearly, H.G. Wells wrote other texts, and there are other sort of areas. We've got The Time Machine, we've got Island of Dr. Moreau, we've got The Invisible Man, we've got Things to Come. Were you ever tempted to actually select another H.G. Wells text to actually work your magic on?
It's a good question. After The War of the Worlds was released, the publisher of the majority of H.G. Wells' works sent me a big box of first editions of pretty much everything that they had published of H.G. with exactly that same question. Fancy having a go with another one of H.G.'s stories. And there were a couple in there that are brilliant, but almost all of them, The Time Machine being one of them, the rights were sold off years ago. And it's not a straightforward thing, if something is in copyright, to just say, right, I'm going to do that one. You have to go through the process of checking out and trying to do a deal, so to speak. The other thing is that when I read The War of the Worlds, unlike many other books I was reading at the time to try to find a subject and something I felt passionate about in the way of a story that I could compose and produce a musical interpretation to, is that The War of the Worlds specifically was actually quite a short story. And on one read, I could hear all the spaces where music could start contributing, rather than some wonderful books. But they were far longer, therefore more detailed and complex to sort of penetrate, to open up into a musical interpretation. So for one reason or another, I didn't move on with another H.G. Wells story, but I have done others, and I'm always looking for a story that one can feel passionate about, feel that there's a relevance into the world we live. And interestingly enough, when H.G. Wells wrote this in 1897, he was taking a serious pop at the expanding British Empire about invading another man's land as being something he didn't completely agree with, one's faith and questioning one's faith as to being, you know, the sort of person that you would go to, a man of the cloth that you go to for spiritual and moral comfort. And somehow H.G. created, who we turned into a parson, played by originally Phil Lynott, as the first person that goes bonkers. He gives up all hope and faith. And I think those resonated to me as issues of the day, of themes that historically have been. And now you look at the world we live in, and it's only magnified. So I think overall I was always looking for something that had great excitement and a simple story in its basic outline, but something that also had a deeper and greater relevance to the world we live in. So finding stories, or certainly in my experience, are not easy or straightforward.
Looking at some of the statistics, of course, from the show itself, we have leaf drops over the audience, surround sound that engulfs them. We have, of course, the 100-foot-wide animation wall, Liam Neeson in full body interacting with the show's live performers. 3D holography, of course, is there. And, needless to say, 35-foot-tall Martian fighting machines firing real flame heat rays. Unbelievable!
It is. That's another item that has kept evolving in the years we've been touring, because it's a machine that H.G. Wells created and described, and we visualized it originally as a painting that came with the original double album. And since we've been touring, it has been this very giant and amazing kit of engineering that, about half an hour into the story, because it's been hiding in the lighting rig, it lands on stage and is firing its main weapon, which now is a five-plumed flame that shoots out over the audience, and it is truly compelling. You definitely feel the heat pretty much wherever you're sitting. It is safe. We haven't lost too many members of the audience.
I was going to say, you could have very frightened people in Nottingham and Newcastle. Goodness knows what could happen there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we're on stage underneath it. I'm conducting right underneath it. It spans probably three-quarters of the stage, and it's three legs and 3 tons are very carefully placed where we are not, but it's a tight fit. And I now, particularly with these real flames, understand why its first name is Heat. As in heat ray.
Jeff, I remember with great excitement when I actually picked up the... I'm chronologically gifted enough to remember, as I say, the first release of the album. I thought, this is something special here, something magical. Little did I think, even at that stage, we would have actually been talking about something which has sold over 15 million records, two UK Ivor Novello Awards, and, of course, won the US Best Recording in Science Fiction and Fantasy with, of course, Alfred Hitchcock, George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, who are kind of... They've developed their own sort of line in various ways, obviously always good. And of course, a Rock Showman of the Year award for your good self, Classic Rock Showman of the Year. The magic still continues, which is why I can't believe this is the last. Surely say it ain't so, Jeff. It can't be.
Well, as we know, it's certainly in the UK, it is going to be the final arena tour, but it's not for a negative reason. It's in fact for a very positive one, which early to mid next year we'll be able to announce the direction that we're going in the immediate future. I'm very excited about it. It's a different way of presenting the War of the Worlds. It won't have me on stage conducting, as has been a privilege for 8.5 years, but it's a new direction, and I hope it will excite audiences in its own way. But it's going to be a different direction. So it's not goodbye, it's just hello in a different way.
Marvellous. Thewaroftheworlds.com, of course, is the go-to website. I'll echo, of course, some of the lines that have been shared here. Newcastle Evening Chronicle, a veritable feast of live stage and musical brilliance. And indeed, from Liverpool Echo, Wayne's music has never sounded more commanding. Genuinely, Jeff, as I said at the start, it's been a privilege to actually share some thoughts with your good self about the fabulous War of the Worlds. As you might have just gathered from my enthusiasm about the whole thing, I just think it's fantastic. It's brilliant. You know, they're very good in every sense of the word, and genuinely endorse that. So we've got two final questions for you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic debut here on the Midweek Drive? Has it been okay for you?
On the what drive?
The Midweek Drive. Has it been okay?
Oh, I'm sorry.
On the show?
Absolutely. I wasn't sure what you said there. I thought we were talking about a Formula One racetrack there.
There you go. It's just the radio program to work it in its own way. Has it been okay for you?
It's been delightful, and thank you for all the super words you said.
Well, the next critical question, Jeff, is can we look forward to, hopefully, in the very near future, featuring you again and actually keeping us updated, not only with, obviously, the War of the Worlds, but other exciting things you're involved with?
It would be an absolute pleasure.
Jeff Wayne, we salute you. Many thanks indeed.
Thank you, too.
Carrie and her father were gone.
The summer sun is fading as the year grows old, and darker days are drawing near. The winter winds will be much colder now you're not here. I watch the birds fly south across the autumn sky, and one by one they disappear. I wish that I was flying with them. Now you're not here. Like the sun through the trees, came to love.
And so much to pack in, even though, of course, it was Justin Haywood and Forever Autumn there, as opposed to the recent incarnation with Liam Neeson doing the role of the journalist, as opposed to Richard Burton. Online now, we have got the legend who actually helped us launch Parsec Volume 1 all those months ago. In fact, if I look to the official time when it went up, the 18th of March, 2014, the year of our Lord, of course, Anno Domini. Parsec Volume 1, brand new science fiction theme show with Dave Milling and Alex Lefchuk, travelling the hyperverse with special guest Alan Stevens.
Hooray.
Dave, Alan Stevens. And
like
Alan's
that,
back with us today. How are you, Alan?
Fine, thank you.
Fantastic. That's good. Dave's been very poorly. He's been doing all sorts of things, so several Parsecs have been kind of solo jaunts.
I've missed three, yes.
Three, quite literally.
Sorry.
Yeah, Paul Money was on last time, and Jamie Anderson, son of Jerry Anderson, etc. Anyway, they're all there. You can access them on southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com. In case people are wondering, they go to the sirenonline.co.uk website, or sirenonline.com website, I think. There's only one.
And you've got into the black
Dave
hole.
Dave Milling isn't mentioned at all. Well, it's there. It all connects. That's important. How can people get in touch with Parsec if they wish to, Dave?
Oh, yes, I've forgotten. You can tweet us at parsec_SIG, Sierra India Golf, or you can email us studio@sirenonline.co.uk and put in the subject field Parsec, and it should find its way to us through the nether sphere.
This month's edition of Doctor Who magazine focuses on Michelle Gomez,
yes,
where the master has become the mistress. Alan, you gave us a very coherent and rational breakdown of your thoughts on what you defined, and I partially quote here, semi-quote, was the best season of Who since Christopher Eccleston on a recent edition of the Midweek Drive. Have you changed your views since then as we move into the more kind of quantitative Alan Stevens consideration of the whole piece?
No.
Good, because I agree with him.
I haven't changed my view at all. No.
Alan, what I particularly liked about... Good morning, by the way, Alan.
Hiya, mate, all right?
Yeah, good, thank you, mate. What I particularly liked about this was the fact that it was back to how I think Doctor Who should be. None of this teeny soapy opera sort of lovey-dovey-dovey thing. And I just thought it was all about the man in the blue box again. And it was what could have been... If this had been Colin Baker's first season, this was how to do it, if you see what I mean. It was that almost a repeat of the sort of the quirky, the sort of not like, do we like this man? But he didn't have a horrible coat, and he didn't have bad scripts, I think, and bad direction. And for me, this, apart from the character of Danny Pink, to be fair, I invested more in the Decimers from the first season of Blake 7 than I did in Danny Pink. There was just something more about the character. I don't know whether it's a writing.
Is that the secret Alan Stevens quote you were going to throw at me earlier on today?
Yeah, that was... I don't know what it was.
He hasn't responded, has he?
No, I think he's...
invested more in the decimals. Probably,
yeah.
I'm listening.
Yeah,
I'm waiting for a gap.
I don't know what, if it was... And the gap's coming. I don't know what, if it was the writing. I don't know if it was a direction.
You're talking about decimal, are we?
So, no. So Danny,
I think it was the tears.
Danny Pink.
Help me! And yeah. Goes, help me!
Well, it
and
was, yeah.
I think that was what made you like the decimals.
Yes, I think it was.
Help me, please!
Help me, please! Oh, dear, he's died. But, yes, I don't know what it was about the character of Danny Pink, whether it was the writing, the acting, the direction. I just could invest more in the little decimals from Blake 7 than I could... Or even the web that surrounded the Liberator. You know, I invested more in that sort of thing than I could direct Danny Pink, and I don't know why.
Right. Okay, there's a number of things you've raised here. The first one concerns Colin Baker's season one in comparison to... it's Colin Baker's first season in comparison to Capaldi's first season. Yeah, I think there are a lot of parallels. A lot of stuff they've actually taken from it as well. I mean, for example, both seasons feature Tyrannosaurus Rex, both feature skeletons. There's a whole load of stuff, which, trees. I put a list recently on Facebook, and there was about 26 similarities. So they're clearly using that as a basis. I would like to point out that Colin Baker, season one, had the ratings basically equivalent to what Doctor Who is getting today. And
yes,
the reason
did.
The show was taken off had nothing to do with the quality. You may have thought season 22 wasn't very good, but it actually had nothing to do with the quality of it, or the Colin Baker's coat, or Colin Baker's performance, or the not very good relationship between, you know, Perry and the Doctor, which is continually shading each other. It had nothing to do with it at all. It was basically down to Michael Grade not liking the program and taking it off. If it had been season 14 or season 13, he would have done exactly the same. He just did not like the show. So a lot of people think, season 22 was awful because they took it off because of it. That isn't true. I mean, it may have been awful in some people's opinions, but it had nothing to do with the cancellation. But you could, in some ways, see that Moffat is so confident now, or powerful within the BBC, that he can happily invoke season 22 and produce an unlikable Doctor and have friction between the companions and still keep the show on the air and not be cancelled. So and there might be a sort of demonstration of megalomaniac power there. Danny Pink, it's a difficult one because Fiona buggered off to Canada and it won't be coming back till Thursday, and we were up to that point watching episodes again in order, like a sort of box set thing.
Yeah.
My opinion of Danny was changing. I mean, first of all, I absolutely loathed the character because, you know, he seemed passive-aggressive and irritating, and, you know, I didn't like him. And it also seemed to me that the Doctor Who, not confidential anymore, is it? What they call them?
Extra, I think.
Yeah,
Doctor Who Extra.
Was showing the actor a lot, and he's a nice guy, the actor.
Yeah, he is.
And so I was kind of getting the impression they were trying to suggest that Danny Pink was a nice guy, where, in fact, a lot of people were saying, no, he isn't. But because I haven't been able to watch it all the way through, I'm not sure. There's two possible things going on with Danny Pink. It could be a case of where the story, Dark Water, Death in Heaven, was basically devised or maybe even written first, and then they were working back from that. So you've got a character working back from his conclusion, as opposed to being, you know, organically created from episode one up. So that could cause a problem. Or it could be a case of we have a number of themes in this season which, when disrupted by having, you know, 7 days between each episode, it's disjointed, and only when you actually watch it in a sort of box set style splurge that the character will actually come together. I mean, also you're thinking, where is this guy going to go? You know, because we have had previous seasons where people have turned up, and you thought, well, where is this going to go? And until you actually get the ending, and not always the ending is good, but sometimes you get the ending, you then say, I may see a form, I may see a shape to where the character was coming from, or where he was going, or what he was all about. And so, you know, I wouldn't like to make a definitive statement that Danny Pink actually was a good character until I've seen all the season in order, and I can't do that until Fiona comes back. But initially I was pretty anti the character, but now I think that, having watched five episodes in order recently. There's a lot going on there, which is lost when you're watching it as a weekly show.
Yeah, I get what you're saying there, Alan. Actually, I can see where you're coming from that, because yeah, if you watch it all in one, then you can actually pick up the links a lot more, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean it's a common thing. I mean, there's a series. People saying, "Oh, I don't understand this." Or people have actually been coming on Facebook saying, "Well, yeah, but if you watch it, you know, in succession." But I mean, on the one hand, that is not very good for a for a show that's a weekly show.
Yeah.
But it's if you look at it as a series called Boardwalk Empire, and if you watch that one episode a week, I'm completely lost. You know, they don't even refer, some of the characters just refer to by the first name, and hang on, who is that guy? You know, where they put a sticker on his back to tell me who he is. And it finished recently, and the first four seasons are made available on Sky, so you could download it and watch it for free. And Fiona and I have been doing that, and been basically, you know, binging and watching, you know, episode after episode. And suddenly, it all makes sense. There's one guy who, for example, gets mugged at the beginning of one episode, and is not referred to again until halfway through the following second episode. And I would have forgot, as this guy only appeared briefly, was punched in the face, and then turned up and complained about it. You know, and so he heard his name, I think, approximately once. It didn't make a lot of sense when I was watching it the first time round. But so it seems to be the nature of TV to basically, yeah. I mean, you know, it's Netflix, and a lot of people do sort of binge watch now, don't they? And I think it's catering more towards, clearly TV landscape is changing, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it is, and I think you're absolutely right, because people download whole things. I know my wife, I bought the entire box set of Voyager last year, and she used to watch it while she was doing planning work for a school teaching. And I said, "Where are you now?" "I'm on season 5, and she's episode whatever." And she used to block watch them on a Sunday. But and she found it a lot easier to get hold of.
Yeah, I think. I mean, I think that back in the old days, a show was self-contained. You know, Spock and Kirk and all will go out and they have their adventure, and within 50 minutes it was all wrapped up, and you didn't have to watch the episode before, you didn't have to watch the episode after. And that effectively is constructed for weekly viewing. All this arc stuff, you know, I know it was kept brought in by TV, but the arcs are becoming more and more complex nowadays, because they realize that people, you know, they do re-watch this stuff. You know, they don't watch it on watch it once and then miss the following episode. They have a dedicated audience who sit down and watch it, and especially Doctor Who fans. I mean, they peck over it and go over it, and they're still talking about episodes from 1963.
I just feel about Target Books, what's going to happen with Target Books. I mean, really, we need to have them back.
We need to have Target Books back.
Alan, we need to move on, so let's ask for numbers from your good self.
Can I just ask Alan one question, please? That is very divisive in Doctor Who fandom.
Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
Alex, you might have your opinion on this as well. What was your opinion on the Cyber Brigadier?
Well, I mean, I think that what they should have done when Nicholas Courtney was alive was to actually brought him back in the TV show and not completely ignore the actor.
Yes.
Now, that wasn't Moffat's fault, that was Russell D. Davies' fault. And then finally, when Moffat took over, he actually asked Nick Courtney, but Nick Courtney was too ill to appear in it. And so it seems almost like they know that they missed the trick here, and they keep making references back to him. The idea of the Cyber Brigadier was apparently a last-minute thing chucked in, probably to... I don't know why he did it. I think it was a bit crass, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, Doctor Who has been enormously crass in the past. When Roger Delgado... When Roger Delgado died in a car accident in 1972, 3 years later they brought the Master back as a rotting, decomposing corpse, which John Pertwee actually voiced as being incredibly distasteful. So, you know, bad taste in Doctor Who it didn't start with a Cyber Brigadier.
Yeah. I thought it was quite a nice resolution.
Well, indeed, and of course, he was actually featured in the Sarah Jane Adventures, so it's all good stuff there. And of course, these days, Kate O'Mara has been substituted by Siobhan Redmond in the Big Finish production of the Ryan.
No, I don't care that.
No. And so it goes, but what are the marks for? We'll go through the last sort of four episodes of the last Capaldi series, and Flatline, first and foremost. What would you give that one?
Me? You're asking me, yeah?
I am, yes.
All right, Flatline was quite a good story. Wasn't too happy with the stories about two-dimensional monsters coming from two-dimensional universe into a three-dimensional universe.
Very similar to Behold Eck, the episode of The Outer Limits, if you've ever caught that one.
I have seen that, yeah. I think actually it was more likely referencing Fear Her.
Yes.
Because that involved people being turned into two-dimensional, you know. But yeah, I do remember The Outer Limits episode. I liked it. I thought it was well-directed. It failed the Bechdel test. And also, I thought it was a bit convenient that she should actually, you know, they should arrive and meet a graffiti artist in a story about two-dimensional picture people coming from a different
My co-pilot is saying, what's the what test?
The Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test. It's a very simple test. Basically, two named female characters have to talk to each other about something other than men. And you'd think that was quite easy, being that 51% of the population...
It's not, though. As a tool for actually analysing film, it's shocking how much the Bechdel test, put together, I believe, by a Canadian scholar, I believe, in terms of when she was actually analysing women-women relations in movies. And it's very low. And as you rightly said, it did fail the Bechdel test.
It did fail a bit. And also, it was a bit convenient that a story about two D people, you know, suddenly involves a graffiti artist. It was a bit too, you know... there was a lot of good stuff in it, so I'd probably give it, you know, 8 out of 10, probably.
Ooh. In the Forest of the Night.
Oh, dear.
In the Forest of the Night. Wow, that was a classic, wasn't it?
Just because you're a screenwriter doesn't mean that you're a successful screenwriter for everything. Doesn't mean you can write Doctor Who.
I think that what often happens is that, you know, you've got to get, I mean, you get 13 episodes done by a certain period of time, with a certain budget, and, you know... And sometimes you're given you think this guy'll do a good job, and he comes in a script and it's an absolute stinker, and you think, like, what do I do? Do I throw it in the bin and start again? And what guarantee do I have that the person who takes over, who will have less time than the previous guy to write it, is going to do a better job? Or do we just go with it? And I think that was the story they just went with. Right. It was possibly one of the worst Doctor Who stories I've ever seen in my entire life. It was like an episode of Galactica 1980, when the writers were actually out to destroy the show in the hope that they would cancel it and they could go on to something else. It was, I don't know, a good -3, eh?
Good heavens.
Worse than Time and the Rani?
Time and the Rani? Worse than... Well, I saw Time and the Rani recently, and Time and the Rani is not very good. But it does have Kate O'Mara taking the mick out of Bonnie Langford and
yes,
running her in dresses by Langford. And on that alone, I would say it was better than Forest of the Night. Oh,
shocker. I'm obviously putting ahead of Robot of Sherwood and Kill the Moon as well.
Well, I don't know, Robot of Sherwood was bad, wasn't it?
Oh, good Lord.
I think the problem with Forest of the Night was it was actually boring.
Yes.
You know, I was bored by it. Although Kill the Moon has got some shocking science in it and some appalling plot development, it's not actually boring. And nor is the Robot of Sherwood. I dislike Robot of Sherwood quite a lot, but I wasn't bored by it. But Forest of the Night, I just thought, when is this going to end? It was like, you know, it was no...
And those cute children actors as well. Wonderful.
Mm. Yeah, they were all awful, weren't they, really? by the way, I would say that you said that, you know, there is a situation where kids do... you know, schools do take kids to museums and they have a sleepover there. That does happen, apparently. Mm-hmm. Although it is a bit better supervised than the one
I would hope so. Exactly. Yeah. Dark Water.
Oh, Dark Water. Yeah, well, when I first saw it, I thought, there's a lot of questions here, and I wonder if they're going to be answered. And sometimes, you know, especially with RTD, they weren't.
Yeah.
But they were. When I watched the second half, I was again thinking, quite grasp all this, and then I watched it both episodes one after the other, taking into account all the questions people have raised on the internet, and it did work out, so I'd give that 10.
Oof. And finally, Death in Heaven.
Well, I'd have to give that 10 as well, because it did manage to sort of take Dark Water also, so yeah, 10.
You've just been listening to Alan Stevens giving his quantitative results there. If Fiona was listening to the podcast in Canada, it had to happen, Fiona. Those numbers had to be there, because I know, quite rightly, being a skilled academic, she didn't want to actually quantify the things. And gets
what do you think about the Father Christmas little insert at the end of... We watched the credits. My wife's first thing to me was... At the end of Death in Heaven. Well, that was depressing. And as she said that, up popped Nick Frost.
Yeah. Well, I kind of think... I think that there was something... I don't know whether he didn't grasp it or what was going on there, but I think there was... my argument always was, if you are doing something, no matter how crazy it is, it has to have internal logic and it's got to make sense. Because the fact is that, you know, people might go, woo, wow, I enjoyed that. Yeah, great, Daleks or whatever. And yet, when they, you know, after they've got over the initial buzz, Doctor Who fans will pore over it and pore over it, and there will be hundreds of books over the next 55 years or whatever analysing it, and if it doesn't stand up, they will point that out.
Yeah.
And I think that what Moffat is doing, he's got the kind of the RTD, you know, bang, flash, whoosh, Cybermen, all this stuff coming along, yeah? But he's actually now decided that it's gonna make sense.
Yes.
So on the surface, you have a, you know, it's just crazy. But when you actually sit down and watch it and go through it, you know, there is thought there, which wasn't
yes,
always the
is.
Case with Russell T. Davies. I think, sorry, what was the question again?
what did you think of the little insert at the end when the credits? Yeah, because
yeah,
well, it was that, quite depressing, wasn't it? And then came bow.
Well, on the one hand, you could say that, you know, Moffat, I remember Chris Boucher saying, I said, you know, if Blake 7 ended, and, you know, what if they brought back a Series 5? He said, I was so confident at that point I could have taken a bit of Blake and a bit of Avon and stuck them together and made it work, because
yeah.
I just knew I could do it. So it could be a case of where Moffat is just so on top of his game at the moment that he thinks, yeah, Father Christmas, and I'll explain it, and when people watch it next week at Christmas, it'll make sense as well. Do you mean? So it could be just that he's, you know, he's so self-confident
yeah.
that he threw it in. And when I watched it, it did seem, you know, what the hell is going on here?
Well,
on the other hand, I would say that there might be, and I'm not sure if this is true yet, because, you know, there are various threads being put in the season which may not be paid off till a season or two later. For example, Gus turning up in Mummy on the Orient Express. Who was he? We have that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
he could be a future companion. Alan Stevens, we thank you for your
contribution.
Hang
on, I've got to finish my line.
Go on quickly.
Oh, go on, forget it.
No,
go
no,
on.
No, I want to hear it. I want to hear it.
It'll
Come
be
on.
A cliffhanger, which we'll
oh,
pick
well,
up in another
well, okay,
match of
I'll say, it could be a situation where, you know, they'd have the idea, because the Doctor Who is a fairy tale character, that any other fairy tale character could appear in a show, and that's perfectly legitimate. And I don't
yes.
think that is legitimate. So it could be a case of where we have a kind of Robot and Sherwood situation again with Father Christmas. And if that's the case, I won't be happy.
No.
I didn't believe them. The Crimson. We went to town with the library.
From the album Venus and Mars, Wings, Magneto and Titanium Man. No, not describing the adventures of Dave Milling and Paul Terry when they were university students together, but it could be. It could be.
Yeah,
Magneto and Titanium Man.
Yeah.
Paul Terry, welcome to Parsec. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm just overcome with excitement and joy and delight, because looking to the left-hand side where I sit at present, I see, well, just pure gold. Pure genius gold. Literary gold. I'm holding it and I'm touching the top 10 of everything 2015. Fantastic. Genuinely.
Thank you.
An absolutely outstanding sort of text here. And indeed, I gather from Dave, it's available for a Parsec competition.
Yes.
It's phenomenal.
Courtesy of his wonderful publishers. Can I just point out that I was Magneto, mainly because I kept eating certain popular-based ice creams and I got a bit fat.
No, Titanium Man, I think you'll find, was slightly more rotund than Magneto.
Oh, well, no, not in my world.
Okay, let's move on. We're not here to talk about the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants, even though we've got the MCM Expo taking place this weekend at the NEC Birmingham. Lots of great stuff happening. Paul Terry, of course, non-fiction author extraordinaire, involved with heaps of shows from Bad Robot, of course, editor of Lost Magazine, Fringe, Disney, The Simpsons, Futurama, of course, co-author of the Lost Encyclopedia with the fabulous Tara Bennett. Just all-round Renaissance man, it has to be said, Paul. And musician extraordinaire with Cellarscape circa 39.
Well, yeah, I like to keep busy, I guess, is the summary to all of that. You're very kind. I don't know about Renaissance Man. I describe myself more as, I guess, obsessive project person.
Yes.
Just things come along, or things, you know, ideas pop into my brain sometimes, and they won't go away. They won't go away until the voices stop, so I have to make them, just have to expel them with words or musical notes, and then I calm slightly and go, all right, well, that's a new record done, fantastic, let's do this book now. So, yeah, I've always been like that since I was at school, really, kind of, but in a productive way, I think, yeah.
We used to lock him in the special room in the IT suite at university when he started talking.
Actually true, till about 3 a.m. sometimes, yeah.
Well, I mean, there seems some wonderful bookendness to this edition of Parsec, which launched with Jeff Wayne and his project War of the Worlds, and we're going to conclude, obviously, with Cellarscape, The Art of Letting Go, from your good self, Paul. But before we before we come around to that, if memory serves, were you not the soul who actually recommended the Rorschach texts?
Oh, dear.
I was.
Yeah. Well,
I know where this is going.
Genuinely outstanding novel featured
in
our...
I bought the book, okay? It's still on my bookshelf.
Dave clearly has not managed to progress to that notion of taking hold of the book and reading it.
The thing is, me old, the way it is that I got the book and I thought, great, on my days off, I'll be able to read it. However, my wife... Okay, Sian, the lovely Sian, decided that...
Are you about to blame your wife for this?
It's sad, isn't it? No. It's sad. I agree,
She basically reminded me that I'd been promising I'd decorate for the past 6 years. The decoration has taken priority over that. And it is on my list of stuff to read over Christmas, though.
Meanwhile, it has also emerged on one of our sister shows and podcasts for Southside Broadcasting, the Book of the Month show. It was awarded a full 9.5 out of 10 across the board. The really outstanding text. And, Paul, we are honoured and pleased that you actually suggested that, because it really is an outstanding book. It's got all sorts of things. Well done.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, sir, and that Dave
Thank
is
you.
Catching up somewhat. But, I agree with the rating. I think the Rorschach text is an extraordinary book, and just a book that sort of can be, you know, at the heart of it, a love story, but be in the most bizarre and, you know, engaging way, and going through very many different, you know, just so many different worlds and realms that I don't think I've come across in a book before. That are, I never like talking too much about the plot, even on like a radio thing, because I'm sure now you read it, you'll understand it.
Absolutely.
You don't want to give it away.
No,
you want
to. Thank you. I appreciate that
because
kindness.
If you start working through that, suddenly you find that the desk in front of you starts decomposing into words, and if we don't actually have those words,
there you go.
Who knows what could happen? You know, it's just weird.
There you go. We are in unspace ourselves.
Oh, every time we do Parsec, Paul. Every time, you know, here we are up to volume 9, volume 10. Looking ahead, of course, big year this year in terms of LongCon 3 that we actually had, the 72nd World Science Fiction Convention. Next year, I can actually say we are looking forward to hosting at the University of Lincoln, the home of Siren FM, amongst other wonderful activities, a full day on telefantasy and society. And I'd like to, on Parsec, formally invite you to take part in that, Paul, if you're willing to come along. Jamie Anderson should hopefully be joining us. Alan Stevens and Fiona Moore will be coming up from Royal College of Holloway. We'll hopefully get some SFX magazine people in as well. Professor Richard Hand from the University of South Wales. What about it, Paul? Do you think you'd fancy coming along to that?
That would be fantastic. Let's make it so.
I'll buy you lunch. I promise I've read the Rorschach text.
If Dave buys me, you know, like a cheese and pickle sandwich, then maybe they'll clinch the deal. Yeah.
Paul, I'll bet you a Victoria sponge, love. How about that?
My goodness. Okay. I can't refuse, can I? I have to come.
Here was I looking to contact Titan Publications for possible sponsorship for Paul, but obviously a cheese and pickle sandwich will do it. That's amazing.
You know, Victoria sponge, yes.
Paul, share with us a present before we go on to this magical cellarscape, The Art of Letting Go. Lots of wonderful media materials happening at present. I noticed you've retweeted our good mutual colleague and friend Tara Bennett, who was in London, in England, a mere 126 miles away from Lincoln.
She was indeed.
So near, yet so far, as she said, although she is back on the Midweek Drive shortly. But she's quite a fan of Sleepy Hollow.
Yes, indeed. Yes, she wasn't here for that show, obviously, but she was here on a top secret assignment and flew in, and I say my lips
cheese
still,
and pickle sandwich.
Flew in and then flew back to America, but it was, I can be slightly smug and say that I know what it was. You'll find out in due course, as the next year unfolds, but it's pretty fantastic. Sleepy Hollow, the Sleepy Hollow magazine actually, is out now. It's out now from Titan Magazine. Issue 1 is launched. And I myself and Tara were very lucky to have crafted quite a lot of material for issue 1.
Fantastic.
Lots and lots of interviews we've done with cast separately. You know, the San Diego Comic-Con last year, of course, had a load of amazing Sleepy Hollow things happen. So we were covering things over there and separate interviews on the phone. We've got sort of profiles on a lot of the demons on the show. Lots of exclusive behind-the-scenes sketches, photography, intel from the producers. It's a really cracking first issue, actually. It's 100 pages, and
it's a bookazine, Paul. It's a bookazine. We can't call it a magazine. It's a
bookazine.
I love
that phrase.
Exactly.
Sleepy Hollow.
It's a mag.
It's a portmanteau. It's a portmanteau term, Dave.
Book I don't like it.
And magazine, a bookazine.
PT, me old China. When you teased me with a bit about coming on, not like you should eat less Magnetos or anything like that.
When you teased me, you said that you'd been busy with a new film, a new project. Oh. Now, one of your previous ones, an internationally award-winning for The Third Man, F-U-R-R-E-D, not third as in some people say third.
No.
Where are we going with this new film? Are you staying in the genre of sci-fi and fantasy?
It's been a lot going on this year, actually. The latest production, which is doing the rounds in film festivals, is called Care, and it's by a Scottish director called Tristan M.G. Aitchison, and that's a kind of psychological chiller, and I was very, very lucky to have been brought on board as the composer for that one. Ooh. And the sound designer. So that is currently doing the rounds. It's a kind of... It's set in a care home, and it's a chiller, and it's very scary, and Tristan has clocked up, I think, 10 or 11 international festivals so far, and he won Best Art Direction in a film festival in Italy recently. So that's doing extraordinarily well. I'm very, very pleased for him. It's a fantastic film. Very, very pleased to have done the score for that one. But there's actually a couple of things coming through at the moment, sort of in the post-production world and pre-production world. There is, in post-production, there is a documentary film called Sydney and Friends, which I'll be able to tell you a lot more about next year. It's an extraordinary piece by Tristan again. It's a feature-length documentary about intersex and transgender communities in Kenya, and it's an amazing piece, and I've been attached to that as composer as well.
Paul, when you said Sydney and Friends, I thought you were referring to Sydney Brister in the series Alias, but obviously it's completely different.
Oh, can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? If I was involved in a retrospective about Alias, I would absolutely go, that would be amazing. This Kenya-based documentary is a wonderful piece that Tristan's in post-production on now, so be more about that in 2015 and beyond.
And of course...
On a genre note, there's a trilogy of documentaries about comic books, which I know that you guys are looking at, called Creator Owned, and I've been attached as the composer and also executive producer of that project, which if you go to creatorowned.com, you'll be able to find out a lot more about that, because you should ask Tara Bennett about it tomorrow, because she's actually the producer of the project.
Or as we like to say in these politically correct days, sequential storytelling. There we are. Move beyond graphic narratives to sequential storytelling. Just keep it real. Exactly.
No, Len Ciccatello is the director of Creator Owned, and there's lots happening with that project at the moment that are very exciting. It's kind of its early stages, but even in early stages, there is a hell of a lot going on.
It's a buzz.
Check that out.
It's a fantastic thing, and it's been a perfect wrap-up to the latest edition and volume of Parsec, but we need to, obviously, amazing enough, we need to discover the act of letting go. We have to let you go, Paul.
Circa 39, the single we're about to release, released last week?
Yes, Circa 39 is the third single from my new album called The Act of Letting Go, under my moniker of Cellescape, and American filmmaker Joel Rickenbach wrote and directed and produced and edited this extraordinary music video for Circa 39, so check that out online on the usual channels, the YouTubes and the Facebooks and things, and I hope you enjoy the song. Thank you so much for your support, guys.
Paul, it's been splendid. I mean, I'm still overwhelmed by holding up. The world's bigger than just a book of number one
we
records.
We need a question.
You better believe it. You know, question, etc. How about, this could be an interesting one, name the author of the Rorschach texts. Would you think that would be okay, Paul?
That's a great question.
There we are. If you want to have the ideal, just in time for Christmas, the top 10 of everything 2015, you can use. How do people get in touch with us on the Parsec show then, David?
They can tweet us at Parsec_SIG. You can email studio@soundonline.co.uk and put Parsec in the subject title. And Alex, feel free to use the same question on the midweek drive, because we've got to involve Tara.
Of course. I've been saying we've been waiting to involve Tara, and she is. She's actually already, Paul, astonishing. She's clocked up something like 9 appearances. Doing very well. And that, of course,
I'm very pleased about that. That makes me very happy. Obviously, I'm a big fan, so having that happen is great.
Well, and Paul, it's time you return to us on other shows as well, obviously, as well as Parsec.
Paul's had 5 appearances, so he's lagging behind somewhat, and I feel personally responsible. For that. So I'm sorry. I will get you up to
Paul
double
Terry
figures.
We'll return. Next up, of course, our December Parsec, which will be probably a Christmas special. I mean, I'm just decided to do it. We might decide to do it for Easter or something, but we'll decide. But working its way through now, the magical sound of Circa 39 with Cellarscape. Paul Terry, fantastic having you on the show. We'll speak again very soon.
Thank you so much, guys. Take care.
Cheers. Take care.
Feel